Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on November 10, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is the second of two talks on the Aryaparyasana Sutta. This sutta is one of the most significant suttas in the Sutta Pitaka, which recounts Siddhartha Gautama's own experience during his search for understanding. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So this is the second half of the Aryaparyasana Sutta. Last Saturday, we went over the part where the Buddha's recounting his encounter with the Alarika Lama and Udaka Ramaputta, two very well-established spiritual teachers of the Buddha's time, teaching something that was rooted in the Vedas, the precursor to modern Hinduism. And the culmination of their path was establishment in the non-physical realms, too. They described this differently. But the Buddha characterized all of these seeking to establish yourself in non-physical realms as simply something fabricated and to be recognized and abandoned. He didn't teach them as any type of higher level of understanding leading to an ultimate goal. There were simply more distractions. And just as common during the Buddha's time as today, these weren't the only two teachers that the Buddha studied with. He studied with many, many, probably dozens of different teachers. And another significant thing in the sutta, he didn't pick and choose something that he liked from this teacher or this tradition and that tradition, learning a chant here and a certain meditation method here and an ideology here and maybe a little political bent from another teacher, and then calling that his Dhamma practice. And look at the subtle eye making and even doing something like that, even though that's encouraged today. Most of the especially in the West, the Western Buddhism glorifies picking and choosing different practices and making it your own practice. That's encouraged. And this is something the Buddha came up against during his time, recognized it as more distraction, and as we see in this recounting, he abandoned that. And then both of these very famous teachers asked Siddhartha, who wasn't awakened yet, asked Siddhartha to come and join them and have a position of power within their organization. And the Buddhist, it wasn't something the Buddha was seeking. He wasn't seeking anything that would continue eye making. You know, he didn't completely understand it at that point, and he certainly wasn't seeking to associate himself with teachings that ultimately didn't lead to awakening. So, let me start. And also, in this sutta, the Buddha doesn't spend much time talking about the severe ascetic practices that he encountered, but he does mention it. So, the Buddha has now left Alarika Lama and Udaka Ramaputta and has continued his search. Along the way, he met those five friends, and they continued to wander around northern India, listening to different teachers and getting into very, very severe ascetic practices. In other recountings, not in this one, the Buddha talks about how he was able to control his breath to such a point that people thought he died. He would take one breath every couple of minutes, which is another common practice today, this breath manipulation. He was practicing such severe self-denial. He was living on one bean or a grain of rice a day. And he talks about in some suttas where he could touch his belly and feel his spine. He was that emaciated. And that leads to where he is today. And again, remember the setting of the sutta. This was a teaching that he gave to a well-focused sangha that Ananda asked him to go and speak to, and so he did. And he's just giving this impromptu teaching, recounting and what I'm trying to say is it's not meant to be a historical accounting. It's meant to be a description of what an ignoble search is, and grasping onto things that might seem wholesome and useful, but are simply more distractions because they're rooted in a misunderstanding of Four Noble Truths. And then eventually what he found to be most useful. And so now we're picking it up where the Buddha has left those five friends. And again, it's not recounted here, but in other teachings and other suttas, the Buddha talks about he passed out from this severe hunger and rolled down the side of the road and into a river. And Sujata, a young girl of 12 years old, dragged him out of the river and nursed him back to health. And then he went into these meditation practice, his meditation practice, that the other recountings use a lot of metaphor in that, in those recountings of the Buddha's final meditation session. He doesn't hear, and I use it often, but I don't think I will anymore because it's really distracting. So now the Buddha's done with all that, and he's now, in his words, "I'm seeking the unexcelled peace arising from skillful understanding. I wandered through the Magadhan country and arrived in Uruvela. This place was delightful with inspiring forests, a clear flowing river with shallow banks and nearby villages for alms." Alms means once a day you go into town with a bowl and you get your food, your sustenance for the day. "This seemed just right for developing jhana." What an important line. Again, remember the series we just went through on jhana. Jhana simply means ever deepening levels of meditative absorption or ever deepening levels of concentration. When the Buddha would say to go meditate, the underlying direction the Buddha taught in the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta, those four foundations of mindfulness. But meditation, as the Buddha teaches, is only, its sole purpose is to deepen concentration or to go do jhana. When he would say it's time to go meditate, he'd say go find the root of a tree or an empty hut and do jhana, meaning do a practice that deepens concentration. He never taught to go do chant or do bowing or contemplate this or figure that out or do any. Go do jhana, and that's what he's saying here. "Friends, while practicing jhana, being subject to birth, to sickness, to aging, to death, to sorrow, regret, pain, distress, despair, to greed, to aversion, to delusion, I realize the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke, the unbinding." And that's the yoke is referring to being attached to or clinging to views ignorant of Four Noble Truths, clinging to wrong views. And it relates directly to the three marks of existence of the impermanence of all things, the not-self characteristic, which the Buddha used the word anatta, a common word during his time, but in a completely different way. The Buddha's use of the word anatta is to mean not-self, meaning the views that you're holding of yourself are rooted in ignorance. They do not describe a self, they're not a self. Let go of those views. And because of a misunderstanding of impermanence and clinging to wrong views, we suffer that third mark of existence, meaning dukkha. And everything the Buddha taught was taught to gain insight into those three marks. And the reason why I'm saying that, and not some generalized insight into any subject we might pick up, which is a common way that insight is taught, especially insight meditation. The Buddha continues, "Knowledge and vision arose in me. Unprovoked is my release." Unprovoked means that there's nothing left rooted in ignorance that would provoke further ignorance. He's cleared his mind of that. "Unprovoked is my release. This is the last birth." Again, the Buddha's not making a claim that he's not saying that. It's not a comment. I'm being very careful about this because there's a lot of misunderstanding about birth and rebirth and what the Buddha taught, and a lot of modern Buddhism gets it wrong. It's not good to have a future birth that would be rooted in ignorance, but what the Buddha is talking about, when you hear it in this context, in the context of being released from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, there's nothing left to give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. This is the last birth. It follows that line, "Unprovoked is my release." Release from views ignorant of Four Noble Truths. This is my last birth. There is now no further becoming. The reason why I titled my book, Becoming Buddha, Becoming Awakened, it relates to the Buddha's teachings on what becoming means, independent origination and other teachings. And it simply means that once I let go of all wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, there's nothing left within my mind to give birth, to provoke another moment rooted in ignorance, to become further ignorant. The Buddha continues, then I had the thought, this Dhamma that I have attained is deep, hard to see and hard to realize. This Dhamma is peaceful, refined, and beyond mere conjecture. What an important line. And remember, the Buddha has now finished 6 years of arduous study, and all that he's found in all these different religious and spiritual practices, he's characterizing here. It's mere conjecture. Why? Because it's rooted in ignorance. It's rooted in fabrications. So it's mere conjecture. The Buddha is seeking a realistic understanding of the nature of suffering in a way that human beings, or at least this, meaning himself, that this human being can understand and make useful. Not something that's a practice that is more distraction that simply makes you feel good or distracts you away from your own suffering. Refined and beyond mere conjecture. This Dhamma is subtle and is to be directly experienced. Another very important line. It's not something that is bestowed on us. The Buddha didn't gain awakening by appeasing to gods or other deities, visualizing deities and finally having awakening dawn on him because of that. It's not based on endless ritual. It's directly experienced, just as he has done. But the world delights in attachment, is excited by attachment, is devoted to attachment, relating to this idea of picking, choosing from different teachers and making it your own, or associating with a teacher such as Alarika Lama or Udaka Ramaputta, which were simply, they were simply teaching to establish the self in a non-physical realm. Establishing the self in a non-physical realm, such as infinite consciousness, the infinitude of space, the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception, etc., is simply clinging yourself to those dimensions, isn't it? It's attachment, as the Buddha is referring to here. Is excited by attachment, is devoted to attachment, and worships attachment. The people that have the most difficulty with my teaching, and also true during the Buddha's time, are those that have developed other teachings and are attached to it, and are, in a sense, they're worshiping that. Remember the fire discourse, or the fire, the Buddha uses that metaphor of fire worshippers who worship fire as creating the suffering in their own mind through that distraction. That's what the Buddha is referring to. We worship attachment. For a world delighting in attachment, excited by attachment, devoted to attachment, worshiping attachment, conditioned towards self-identification from dependence on ignorance, this Dhamma is hard to see. Which really is saying, the more conditioned your mind is to the things that might seem reasonable and might have a common agreement as being some type of practice, it makes it very hard to see. And that's exactly the experience that I've had from this seat. And those of you that have had any type of a spiritual practice or a religious practice, and it might be not Buddhism, it might be like a Christian religion, or some other Hebraic, is that, if that's the right word, religion, will have had difficulty just accepting this, not as a religion, but simply as a way of living in the world. And so the Buddha didn't teach another religion. He wasn't interested in as establishing himself as a savior. He wasn't trying to teach another salvific religion. He just figured out a way to see the world clearly and see himself in the world in a realistic way. And that's what he taught. That's awakening. The Buddha continues, the awakened state is also hard to realize. The awakened state is this. The resolution of all fabrications. Remember how dependent origination begins. From ignorance as a requisite condition, ignorance of Four Noble Truths as a requisite condition, it's required, comes fabrication. And then the rest of the chain of dependencies, it follows, ending in all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. Fabrications are another word for that. If you remember the Anuradha Sutta, the word fabrication in that sutta is used to describe fabrications is the word that's used is perversion. What is that? We've perverted the reality out of ignorance of Four Noble Truths, so we've created wrong views that we are now attached to. And one of the most remarkable things that I've seen from this seat, but also understanding my own development of understanding, is the very powerful but subtle strategies we will, as human beings, do commonly to ignore our own ignorance. And once we've established that in our minds, that's called conditioned thinking. We've conditioned ourselves to believing these certain things. It's nearly impossible to let go of it because we'll continue to create those strategies to justify and rationalize these beliefs that are rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That's the essence of the Buddhist teaching and the reason why he taught an Eightfold Path, because he understood the nature of ignorance. He didn't awaken and then say, I learned this from this teacher. It sounded pretty good. I learned this from that teacher. I learned this. Do this ritual. Do that. And then you'll have some kind of Dharma practice. Because he realized that would just continue suffering. It would be cruel to teach that once you have attained that awakened state that the Buddha did. He taught a very specific and singular path to awakening. And that's really the point of the Aryaparyasana Sutta, recognizing and abandoning what is ignoble or unskillful and developing what is noble or skillful. That's what he's talking about. So he begins with that. The resolution of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all fabrications, the ending of craving, and it's not just craving for a bigger piece of chocolate cake or craving for the right relationship or a new car or a bigger house. Those are part of craving, but really what the Buddha's talking about is the craving rooted in fabrications, which is craving for continual self-identification or continued eye-making. The development of dispassion, the development of cessation of living a life rooted in wrong views, the development of unbinding from those wrong views. Now the Buddha's thinking this to himself. Now if I were to teach the Dhamma and others would not understand me, that would be tiresome for me, troublesome for me. He realizes how difficult it's going to be to teach this to a human population that is rooted in ignorance. So he's debating if it's even worthwhile to get up off his cushion and start teaching. Just then this realization, never known before, occurred to me. This is another important line that the Buddha uses to refer to the Eightfold Path, as the Eightfold Path is a path never heard of before. Many of the modern Buddhist schools say that the Eightfold Path is a path that was around endless eons in the past, and the Buddha was simply one Buddha among an endless number of Buddhas. The Buddha repeatedly said, this is something that's never been heard before. It's a timeless path, which means that it is noble throughout time. It's useful throughout time. But he always said, this is something that's never been heard before. He's reiterating that here. Just then, this realization, never known before, occurred to me. I'll dismiss teaching that which only with great difficulty I attained. This Dhamma is not easily realized by those overcome by greed, aversion, and delusion, the three defilements. This Dhamma is difficult to understand, subtle, deep, contrary to common belief. Again, a reference to that idea that whatever we decide is a wholesome practice must be. Contrary to common belief, those delighting in passion, their minds obscured in darkness, will not understand. So the next part of this sutta uses metaphor in reference to a Brahmin that enters the Buddha's mind. Of course, the Buddha's using metaphor. There's an article on the website called Mara and Metaphor on the website that explains this in detail. The Buddha used metaphor in this way because it was a common teaching tool. And those that he's teaching understand that what he's referring to, excuse me, what he's referring to in metaphor is either to describe a heightened mind state or a troubled mind state, as in the case of Mara. Mara is metaphor for a mind continued in conflict and rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Then Brahma Sahampati became aware of my thoughts. The world is lost, destroyed. The Arahant, the rightly self-awakened one, is inclined to dwelling in ease and not teaching his Dhamma. The Buddha is just describing the struggle in his own mind, should he teach and should he not teach. Brahma Sahampati left his realm and came to me. He knelt on his right knee, bowed, and said, "Rightly self-awakened one, please teach your Dhamma. Please teach your Dhamma. There are those with just a little dust in their eyes. They are suffering because they will not hear your Dhamma. There are those that are able to understand your Dhamma." Brahma Sahampati continued, "In the past, there appeared among the Magadhans an impure Dhamma." Now he's talking about all the different teachers and teachings of the time. "An impure Dhamma devised by the ignorant. Teach your Dhamma to end the pain of birth, of sickness, of aging, of death. Teach your Dhamma to end sorrow, regret, distress, despair. To end greed, aversion, and delusion." That's how the Buddha described dukkha, remember it. "Teach your Dhamma so they can also realize the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke, the unbinding from views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Just as one standing on a high peak might see people below, you, the wise one, with profound vision, must take your place in the palace of the Dhamma," meaning his rightly self-awakened one, the one that understands now, the palace of the Dhamma. "Free from suffering, look on those suffering, oppressed with birth and aging. You have conquered ignorance. Be a great teacher and wander without entanglements to false dharmas. Teach your Dhamma. There will be those who will understand." Now the Buddha is thinking to himself, "Mindful of Sahampati's plea and out of compassion for all beings, from my awakened state I looked out onto the world." Now remember in the Loka Sutta, the Buddha is describing just post his awakening, he looked out on the world and he described it this way, "The world is aflame. I looked out on the world, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and beings with much. I saw uncluttered beings," referring to their mind state, "and dull beings. I saw beings with good qualities and beings with bad qualities. I looked out onto the world and I saw beings hardened in their views, disgraced, in danger. I looked out onto the world and I saw those who would be easy to teach my understanding, my right view. It is as if a pond is permeated with red, white, and blue lotus, born and growing, immersed in the water. They flourish permeated with cool water from their root to tip, never standing above the surface. Even so, some might rise up and emerge from the murky water." So again, the significance of this part of the sutta refers to the Buddha not seeing himself as a savior and going out to save the whole world. He realized that there's going to be only a few people that will be able to understand and develop his Dhamma. And yet, as you'll see in just a few moments, he gets up and teaches those few. "Seeing thus, I decided to teach my Dhamma, to open the world to the Eightfold Path, to cessation. Those with eyes to see and ears to hear could come forth in conviction. Those lacking the eyes to see or ears to hear the pure Dhamma, I would not teach my Dhamma, my refined and pure Dhamma." Again, the Buddha's not talking about holding it back out of resentment or anything, just in a practical way. This is an aspect of right speech. It's an aspect of wrong speech to insist that somebody listen to and develop the Dhamma if they're simply not interested. Skip over some of my commentary. "I would teach the pure Dhamma tirelessly and untroubled." Brahma Sahampati was pleased. He bowed and disappeared. In other words, a conflict. The Buddha had now resolved the conflict in his mind whether he should teach or not teach. Then the thought occurred to me, "Who should I first teach the Dhamma to? Who will quickly understand?" I love this part here. "I thought of Alara Kalama, wise, intelligent, competent, but I heard that he had passed a week ago." So the Buddha, even though he dismissed Alara Kalama's teachings, he didn't dismiss him from learning the Dhamma. He didn't he wasn't harboring any type of resentment or anger or anything. He was hoping that he could go find his teacher and teach him what he understood. But he heard that he had passed a week ago. I thought, what a great loss it was to my friend Alara. He would have quickly learned my Dhamma. Then I had the thought of Adhaka Ramaputta. He too is wise, intelligent, and competent. But I heard that he had passed just last night. It was a great loss to my friend Udaka, who, as well, he too would have quickly learned my Dhamma. I then thought of the five friends I wandered with while attending to ascetic practices. I knew they were in the deer park at Isipatana. I took my leave to wander in stages to Isipatana. Along the way, I encountered Upaka. So the very first teaching was not a successful one. It wasn't to those five friends, but this, you'll see, this is not very significant. Except to reflect the hardened views that Upaka had. Along the way, I encountered Upaka, the Ajivaka. That just refers to where he was from. He noticed my composure, my complexion bright. He inquired, on whose account have you gone forth? Who is your teacher? In whose Dhamma do you delight? I told Upaka, I have left the world behind through my own understanding. I am released from all wrong views. Again, getting right to the heart of his Dhamma. From all phenomena, empty of ignorance, I am free of craving. My realization is taught by none. To whom should I declare as my teacher? In response to his question, who is your teacher? I have no teacher, as one like me cannot be found. I have no counterpart, for I am an arahant in the world, an awakened one in the world. I am the unexcelled teacher, rightly self-awakened. The fires of passion are cooled. I am unbound. I will set the wheel of the true Dhamma rolling. I am traveling to Kasi. In a world afflicted with the darkness of ignorance, I beat the drum of wisdom. What a wonderful, beautiful line. I beat the drum of wisdom. Upaka replied, from what you claim, you must be the ultimate conqueror. There's mocking. I don't know if I'm conveying it right, but that Upaka is mocking. You must be the ultimate conqueror. The Buddha responds, conquerors like me have abandoned greed, aversion, and delusion. So there's nothing, a conqueror in that term would be someone who's conquering someone else or the next village or the next country to overtake that and increase their own riches. Conquerors like me have abandoned greed, aversion, and delusion. I have conquered all evil qualities. You are correct, Upaka. In that sense, I am a conqueror. Upaka, unconvinced, shook his head and took his leave. He wasn't convinced. I continued to the deer park. From afar, my five friends saw me. I was no longer gaunt from ascetic self-denial. Thinking that I was living luxuriously, they decided to not show me respect. As I approached, they noticed my awakened state. Standing in respect, they took my robe and bowl and prepared a seat. One of my friends took a bowl and began to wash my feet as a sign of respect. They, however, addressed me by my familiar name, by his family name, which is a sign of disrespect. Friends, do not address the Tathagata, a rightly self-awakened one, in this way. I am rightly self-awakened, a worthy one. Listen carefully, my friends. I have realized the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke, the unbinding. I will teach you my understanding. Practice as I instruct you, and shortly you will realize the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke, the unbinding. What he's telling his friends is that they are still rooted in wrong views, and he will teach them a way to unbind from that yoke of being attached to wrong views. And those views are a culmination of their own incorporation and picking and choosing of different practices. The group of five replied, from your practice of the austerities, you did not attain any superior state or any higher knowledge or vision worthy of a noble one. So again, they have decided that it is this practice of austerities that will lead to awakening. And since the Buddha had abandoned that particular practice, there's no way that he could have awakened. How can you now, living luxuriously, straying from your exertion and backsliding into abundance, have attained any superior state or any higher knowledge or vision worthy of a noble one? That's kind of the same argument that's made to continue to dismiss the Buddhist teaching 2,600 years later. If there's even a mention of Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path, it's taught almost as an introduction to the Dhamma, if you want to think of it as an introductory to a book about the Dhamma. I can't tell you how many students I had, and I just had one online that said just that, that they've been practicing at this different center and this lineage and that teacher, and nobody, and I think they said 6 years, nobody has ever mentioned Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path. That's what the Buddha's referring to. And they are insisting that unless the Buddha had developed awakening from what they're attached to, he couldn't possibly have awakened. I replied that Tathagata is not living luxuriously or strayed from his exertion or backslided into abundance. That Tathagata, as the Buddha is referring to himself by the Tathagata, is a worthy one, rightly self-awakened. Listen carefully. I have realized the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke. He's reiterating that. Listen carefully. I'm telling you. The unbinding. I will teach you my understanding. Practice as I instruct you, and shortly you will also realize the unborn and the unexcelled. He's also telling them you need to abandon what you've developed so far, because that is part of your yoke, that your yoke, your attachment to wrong views. The release of the yoke, the unbinding for yourself right here and now. He's making a declarative statement. Take up the Dhamma and you'll awaken right here and right now. Not endless eons in the future, as modern Buddhism portrays awakening. A second and third time, they doubted me and questioned me in the same manner. I then asked them, have I ever claimed to be a rightly self-awakened one before? That question is just as pertinent today as it is then, isn't it? You have never before claimed to be rightly self-awakened. I replied again that Tathagata is not living luxuriously or strayed from his exertion or backslided into abundance. I mean, the Buddha's still in you know, put together robes and eating out of one bowl a day. The Tathagata is a worthy one, rightly self-awakened. Listen carefully. You know, that line, the worthy one, is referring to I'm one that's worthy to be listened to. And it's also in reference to those that aren't. Again, the ignoble search and the noble search. That's the context of what he's teaching. So he's teaching these five friends who he cares deeply for to recognize what is an ignoble, unskillful search and what is a noble search. He's one who has established himself as a worthy one to listen to because he has awakened. He's a rightly self-awakened one. The Tathagata is a worthy one, rightly self-awakened. Listen carefully. I have realized the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke, the unbinding. I will teach you my understanding. Practice as I instruct you, and shortly you will also realize the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke for yourselves right here and now. Again, he's reiterating that point. And so I convinced them of my knowledge and wisdom. Over time, living on alms, I instructed the group of five. Being subject themselves to birth, to sickness, to aging, to death, to sorrow, regret, pain, distress, despair, to greed, to aversion, to delusion, and now understanding the suffering of birth, of sickness, of aging, of death, of sorrow, regret, pain, distress, despair, of greed, of aversion, of delusion, they attain the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke of unbinding. So the Buddha is not teaching the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta here. He's recounting what they'd learned from that teaching, the first teaching on Four Noble Truths. And the significance of that repetition of birth, sickness, aging, and death, and then understanding that, is the Buddha teaching that wherever we are, even though at the moment we're subject to birth, sickness, aging, and death, we're subject to dukkha, to reacting to the disappointment of not getting what we want or receiving what we don't want. The Dhamma begins there. Excuse me. The point I'm making is that the Dhamma, including meditation, is not an escape from the world or an escape from our suffering. And it was never meant to be. The Buddha taught a Dhamma, as he's recounting here, that no matter how ignoble or unskillful our search might have been up until this point, no matter what we've attached ourselves that is resulting in in ongoing disappointing and unsatisfactory experiences, confusion, delusion, and dukkha, the Dhamma begins right where we're at. And that's such an important point, because we don't have to become better people to make ourselves better people, which is a modern distraction, and especially in modern engaged Buddhism. The Dhamma begins wherever we are. And as the Buddha just recounted, then you can attain the yoke of unbinding. In the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, at the conclusion of that sutta, you remember Kandana declares, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation, and the Buddha says, you are now Anakandana, the one who understands. What Kandana is saying very briefly is he understands the three marks of existence. All conditioned things that arise, meaning in his mind, are subject to cessation. And you also remember, especially those that have been on retreat, the first three suttas that the Buddha taught, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Anattalakkhana Sutta, the Sutta on the Not-Self-Characteristic, and the Fire Discourse, recounts all of that. And by the end of that second sutta, which the Buddha is referring to here, the Anattalakkhana Sutta, this original five awakened. And at the time of that third sutta, there were about 1,000 folks in attendance, and they all awakened. And the significance of that, again, shows the misunderstanding that is commonly applied, that awakening as a Buddha teaches awakening, or not as a Buddha teaches awakening, as Buddhism teaches awakening, is a nearly impossible thing to attain, and it takes endless eons. Listen to the Dhamma, develop the Dhamma, and in this lifetime and right here and now you will awaken. I'm skipping over some of my commentary. Friends, craving and clinging arises from the five senses. Forms known from the eye, agreeable, pleasing, enticing, enchanting, are linked to sensual desire. Sounds known from the ear, agreeable, pleasing, enticing, enchanting, are linked to sensual desire. Aromas known from the nose, agreeable, pleasing, enticing, enchanting, are linked to sensual desire. Tastes known from the tongue, agreeable, pleasing, enticing, enchanting, are linked to sensual desire. Tactile sensations known from the body, agreeable, pleasing, enticing, enchanting, are linked to sensual desire. Those are the five physical senses. We often talk of the sixth sense base, including the sixth sense of thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. But what the Buddha is teaching here is when your mind is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, of the true reality of human existence, you will interpret that, the world, through your senses in this way that is conditioned from your view. Of course, that makes sense, isn't it? You remember the series we went through a couple months ago on the wisdom of restraint. At the sixth sense base, as where we encounter the world, is where we practice restraint and bring our Dhamma practice into that point. That's what the Buddha is referring to. This is the craving and clinging that arises from the five senses. Any contemplative, any Brahmin, any seeker who clings to sensuality in this manner, the Buddha is using these words to speak to common practices, contemplative practices. Most meditation practices today are contemplative. They're more contemplation than meditation, by the way. Or Brahmins, meaning those that have established themselves as having spiritual knowledge, the Buddha is saying, no. And any seeker who clings to sensuality in this manner, which is another way of saying you cling to something that is fabricated, who clings to sensuality in this manner, infatuated and enchanted with sensuality, without understanding the suffering that follows, or the path to cessation, should be known as unfortunate in having met ruin. Again, referring to attaching yourself to an ignoble or unskillful search or practice. They have lost their minds and the world will have its way with them. It is as if a wild deer were caught in a heap of snares. This deer has met misfortune and ruin. A hunter could do what they want with them at will. In the same manner, any contemplative, any Brahmin, any seeker who clings to sensuality in this manner, infatuated and enchanted with sensuality, without understanding the suffering that follows or the path to cessation, should be known as unfortunate in having met ruin. They have lost their minds and the world will have its way with them. That last line to it, I need to comment on. Any seeker. So often it's enough today, and it was for me for a long time, to just identify myself as a seeker and attach myself to some practice that was in some way seemingly religious or spiritual. In my case, it was a lot of different Buddhist practices. The Buddhas recognize that identifying yourself simply as a seeker is often enough for people. And you believe, and usually because it's taught this way, that if you just keep seeking, somehow through grace, awakening, or in the case of most teachings, you'll end up in heaven, in some type of heaven. That's what the Buddha is referring to here. Now know this, friends. Any contemplative, any Brahmin, any seeker who no longer clings to sensuality in this manner, not infatuated or enchanted with sensuality, understanding the suffering that follows from craving and clinging, and the Eightfold Path to cessation, should be known as fortunate and will not meet ruin. Getting very specific, the Buddha is teaching that if you're stuck in those types of wrong views, what is going to be developed from those fabricated views is simply going to be more suffering. You have literally, as a Buddha saying, you've lost your mind, and it's an unfortunate state. Those that have developed the path, as a Buddha saying here, the Eightfold Path, will awaken. They should be known as unfortunate and will not meet ruin. They have control of their minds, and the world will not have its way with them. The name of the sutta right now, where the Buddha teaches that we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think. Jen, do you remember the name of the sutta?
No.
I say it often,
no,
but
yeah.
I'm just caught up in this. We gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think. And isn't that marvelous? Isn't that worth all the effort that we put into Dhamma practice? That's a common peaceful mind, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I can't believe I forgot the name of the sutta. They have control of their minds, and the world will not have its way with them. It is another way of saying we've disentangled ourselves from the world. It is as if a wild deer avoided a hunter's snare. This deer has not met misfortune and has avoided ruin. A hunter could not do what they would will with them. In the same manner, any contemplative, any Brahmin, any seeker who does not cling to sensuality in this manner is not infatuated. In other words, no matter how distracted or ignoble your path or your searching might be, if you gain the ability to not cling to sensuality, not cling to those wrong views, in this manner, who is not infatuated or enchanted with sensuality, who understands the suffering that follows from craving and clinging, and understands the path to cessation, should be known as fortunate and will not meet ruin. They have control of their minds, and the world will not have its way with them. How often has we felt that we have no control over it? The world has its way with us, and there's nothing we can do about it. Well, you can. It is as if a wild deer is living carefree in all ways. The Buddha is now saying, we can live like that wild deer, carefree in all ways. Why is it carefree? Because it has gone beyond the hunter's range, or the snares of the world. In the same way, those engaged in the noble search, established in seclusion from sensuality and unskillful mental qualities, enters and remains in the first jhana, bringing us all the way back to the importance of using meditation for the sole purpose of deepening concentration. They enter and remain in the first jhana. This first jhana is experienced as rapture born of that very seclusion. It is accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. So I'm not going to go through the whole explanation of the jhanas. We just went through that series. And if you want to refresh it, it's all on the website. They have become lost to Mara, lost to the effects of wrong views. So even as we start to begin to establish the proper meditation practice within the framework of the path, the Buddha's including that in this reference, and we have become lost to Mara, meaning we have become lost to views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The ignorance can't attach itself to us anymore, and we will no longer attach itself to that, beginning with a concentration practice. Furthermore, those engaged in the noble search enter and remain in the second jhana. This second jhana is experienced as rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Free of directed thought and evaluation, with internal assurance, the joy of concentration permeates their entire mind and body. Remember the setting again. He's teaching these five buddies this is what you do as a proper meditation practice, and this is what you look for, this ever-deepening concentration. They have become lost to Mara and to the effects of wrong views. Furthermore, those engaged in the noble search and to remain in the third jhana, which is equanimous and mindful of pleasant abiding. With the fading of rapture, this pleasant abiding permeates their entire mind and body. They have become lost to Mara, lost to the effects of wrong views. Furthermore, those engaged in the noble search enter and remain in the fourth jhana, which is pure equanimity and mindful. This is the fourth jhana is simply a deeper establishment of that third jhana. Being pure, neither pleasure nor pain is seen. They sit permeated in mind and body with pure, bright awareness. They have become lost to Mara and lost to the effects of wrong views. And further still, those engaged in the noble search with complete abandonment of self-identification to form, with a fading of aversion, with the cessation of craving here and there, they enter in and remain in the dimension of the of infinite space. So this is not a reference that this establishment of the or recognition of infinite space is something that is an aspect of deeper concentration. It's just a reference back to what Alara Kalama and Udeka Ramaputta taught. And he's including it here to show his five friends that even those practices that you practice are just as fabricated as everything else. Let me continue. And further still, those engaged in a noble search with complete abandon of the dimension of infinite space, they enter and remain in the dimension of infinite consciousness. Now he's just going through these different common non-physical establishments during the Buddha's time and just as common today. And further still, those engaged in the noble search with complete abandonment of the dimension of infinite consciousness, they enter and remain in the dimension of nothingness, and which is one of the most common teachings today, especially in Zen Buddhism, that the ultimate goal is to establish yourself in nothingness. There's no such thing as a self. There's no self, which is completely different than not self. Or the ultimate establishment is the understanding of emptiness, that we all live in this kind of amorphous, empty, nothingness void. It's not something the Buddha taught. In fact, he specifically teaches that that's just another fabricated mind state. And also, there's other ones that are mentioned, the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. All of those are fabricated. And I'm going to skip over a few of those because it just gets repetitive. But the Buddha is saying to his friends and to us 2,600 years later that anytime you seek to establish yourself in a non-physical realm, it's just an ignoble search. It's just rooted in fabrication. And sometimes that can happen to us spontaneously without being directed to do that. I mean, a lot of modern Buddhist practice direct you to establish yourself that way. But sometimes we find ourselves in a mental state that feels like we've lost all self-reference. But we need to be careful then, because this can happen spontaneously. And what do we do when we find ourselves in this blissful state of no self-reference? Rather than attach ourselves to it and think that we've attained something, what do? We look to deepen concentration, come back to our breath.
No, we don't, though. We sit and enjoy it.
And here I should say, and I'll put a little qualification on it because I do the same thing. It's okay to enjoy it. Recognize that it's not an ultimate goal.
Yeah.
It's simply an establishment and a pleasant abiding. And in that way, you can say that it's at least a third jhana or a fourth jhana. It doesn't, and don't get too crazy about which jhana I'm in either. Yeah. They were never taught that way. They're taught just to recognize ever deepening levels of concentration. And like we heard in the Anapada Sutta from 2 weeks ago, the Buddha using Sariputta as an example of a proper meditation practice, how Sariputta went through these different levels of jhana, and even when he got to the fourth jhana, he realized there are still deeper levels of concentration. So that, again, the jhanas aren't taught to be, as achievement, they're simply as a way of recognizing that we are engaged in right meditation, and how do we recognize it? Because our concentration is increasing. So when we find ourselves in that blissful state of no self-reference, as Lorna said, enjoy it for a little while, recognize it as fabricated, kind of like a warm bath, isn't it? And come back to the sensation of breathing. And in that way, you are taking control of your minds. You're not becoming lost to, I want to just be in that blissful state. Because what happens there? for one thing, your meditation practice then is always going to be disappointing and it's always going to be distracting. But when you train yourself, no matter how wonderful this feels in this moment, what I'm doing now is I'm doing jhana. Right? It's such a, again, all those teachings on jhana and how the Buddha teaches meditation, that's the point.
So John, in a sense, we're using our consciousness to control our unconscious mind.
Boy, that's a great way of putting it, Mary. Yes. To not have our unconscious or conditioned mind rule our lives, which is what most of us do, whether we realize it or not. And the Buddha's teaching that we can do that right here and right now, but it has to be through a noble search and a noble practice.
I'd love to see this all done with some being functional MRI. It's really going on
there. I would too.
Yeah.
Well, they've done those tests, yeah. And they can tell that people that have not just this meditation, any meditation will help us to quiet your body and quiet your mind, and so your rhythms will change, and your mind does react to that, to a quieter mind. It would be interesting to see what Siddhartha's mind would look like on an MRI, though. But again, just to reiterate the point, this long sutta and all the other teachings that the Buddha teaches were always in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. The Buddha only taught one path called an Eightfold Path, nothing else, and he only taught one single meditation method, and that was what we call today. It wasn't called that back then, Shamatha Vipassana meditation. His instructions are very clear, and the point of meditation, the Buddha kept coming back to that. The mentions of jhana are also all throughout the Buddha's teaching career to continually reemphasize that we meditate to deepen concentration. Why? Because a mind rooted in ignorance is prone to distraction. What would be the antidote to distraction? Concentration. And further still, those engaged in the noble search with a complete abandon of the... Again, this is just reference to other non-physical planes where the Buddha teaches. They're just fabricated. Don't seek them. Free of reaction, knowledge and wisdom well established, greed, aversion, and delusion are completely overcome. And the position of this in the sutta is important. After he goes through this long list of common non-physical realms that people seek during the Buddha's time and today, he makes that statement, free of reaction. So these states, while they might be pleasant, have an aspect of reaction to it. And a reaction doesn't necessarily mean I don't like it. A reaction is, wow, this feels great. That's a reaction. Mm. It's a good way of saying that.
You've done that, you're back into fabrication.
It's a good way of recognizing that too. Yeah. If you recognize that, wow, this feels great. Look what I've attained.
Yeah.
You can stay there for a little while, but recognize.
Yeah.
That there's reaction there.
Yeah.
Most of us only attach reaction to something unpleasant. Reaction is something that is mindless at its core.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it doesn't mean we shouldn't appreciate or enjoy that pleasant state or things of the world. But we can do that, and we're much more mindful when we're not reacting to the things of the world. In fact, good to see you, Mary. Free of reaction, knowledge and wisdom well established, greed, aversion, and delusion are completely overcome. They have become lost to Maya, lost to the effects of wrong views. Having engaged in the noble search, they are unattached to anything in the world or fabricated from worldly influences. That last line was my comment. They are as carefree as a deer far removed from a hunter's range. Why are they as carefree as a deer far removed from a hunter's range? Because they have completed the noble search and through their own efforts, excuse me, have gone beyond Mara's reach. Through their own efforts, they have gone beyond the reach of their own ignorance. They have gone, Buddha continues, they have gone beyond the reach of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Those who have engaged in the noble search, who have completed the Eightfold Path, are said to be rightly self-awakened. This is what the great teacher said in that group of five, with the light of him hearing those words. It's the end of the sutta. Thank you. What a marvelous sutta. I came across it quite a few years ago. And I didn't teach it for a few reasons. I did teach the shorter version called the Pariyasana Sutta, which is called the Sutta on Ignoble and Noble Searches, but it's not nearly in depth, and it's not really a recounting of the Buddha's awakening. This teaches what the Buddha went through, what he recognized as ignoble, unskillful, and because of his determination. Now think about this. We are fortunate because we have the Buddha's description of his ignoble and noble searches to understand what we must do if we're going to take to the Dhamma. He didn't. The brilliance of this man is he knew, though, even Thrumalara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta, that the culmination of their establishment in these non-physical realms was not it. It didn't relate to the goal. And just as he recounted to his five friends, that's simply part of what the Buddha describes as dukkha, isn't it? Birth, sickness, aging, and death, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want. It's all part of impermanence. So even the establishment in a non-physical realm, whether it's spontaneously or determined, is an impermanent place. And it's through self-identification, self-establishment that we do that in. And so any practice that is not framed by the Eightfold Path, and there really is no other, it is the Eightfold Path, is something that the Buddha taught to recognize as unskillful and abandon it. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't do things that are pleasant. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't go to yoga class or do, certainly not Qigong is very complimentary to this, or other things. If we like to chant, you could chant. If you like to bow a lot, you could do that. But recognize and don't try and reconcile it to your Dhamma practice. Recognize that this is what the Buddha taught as a path to awakening. Anything else might be pleasant entertainment, but it's simply not part of the Dhamma. And how do we know it? Because the Buddha taught that wonderful Eightfold Path to frame our practice. And if we're engaged in the Eightfold Path as our Dhamma practice, we won't be engaged in other things as Dhamma practice. So another reason why I've kind of waited to teach this is that our Sangha itself is developing, and I think you'll understand more now the reason why I spend a lot of time teaching what it is and what it isn't. Why? Because I learn from learning how the Buddha taught, doing exactly the same thing. And I honestly, at first, it kind of was off-putting to me because I thought, this sutta is unnecessary, but it goes, why is it going into this? Until I realized the nature of my own ignorance was that I was so attached to other things. One of the reasons we get attached to it is simply because we put our time into it, and our associates or our friends are part of something. So for many years, I was part of a specific Tibetan lineage. It was difficult to completely put that behind because I was so self-identified with that lineage, and I put so much time in developing it, even though everything about it was contrary to what I was finding in the Buddhist teaching. And the same thing when I went to the Zen schools and started hanging out at Zen Mountain Monastery, that it's such a wonderful group of people, and I put so much time learning what their teachings were, that now I have this vested interest. I have a self-identification with being this type of Zen Buddhist. Very, very difficult to recognize it and abandon it. But that's what the Buddha's speaking, and he just went through that with his five friends, saying, I know what you went through. We studied with the same people. This is where it led you to. It's a wrong view rooted in ignorance of this that I'm going to teach you. And so truly understanding this sutta and the reason why the Buddha teaches why he teaches and the reason why I teach the way I teach brings us to a very simple and accessible Dhamma practice, doesn't it? And if we engage in it the way the Buddha teaches it, we can engage in it free of distraction. We can simply take to it and awaken, just as the Buddha said, right here, right now. So that's my talk for today. Any questions about this sutta? And we'll go around the room.
That's right. I leave early.
Good to see you, Anthony.
Okay. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Jen, good to see you this morning.
It's good to see you. One of the questions. I was getting distracted by the birth, where he says, "This is my last birth,"
mm-hmm.
and that made me think about not to be born again into this world. And this is your last birth. Like,
as far as we know.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean.
Anything else is speculation.
Yeah, right. So, it seems like a lot of controversy around saying that.
And a lot of misunderstanding.
And hearing it told within this context. Taught within this context was different for me today, because I had felt like even other times that I'd heard it, it was like, you can't say that. Even though I don't really have any religious, it just somehow seemed like incorrect, wrong, and it was just, I feel like my conditioning somehow that was like, well, yeah, this is your last birth. And even, okay, that's what he was saying in the context of dependent origination, but it is really your last birth.
Well, he's saying it really in two contexts. One is in relation to dependent origination, but also, remember, those five friends had developed the same beliefs that the Buddha did, mostly rooted in the Vedas, which teach endless birth. And
yeah.
So he's also saying that when you awaken, that's something else that you have put aside. There will be no further births. And so the Buddha didn't get into it here. He's also correcting their view of karma and rebirth, saying, and much like we knew from Angela Miller and other people that came across the Buddha's path, once you awaken, there's nothing, there's no even consideration about a future birth. Because there's no self-referential I making left in your thinking. So even if there is such a thing, it becomes a moot point that
right.
You might be it's not even a moot point. It's there's no point at all to it, because you are simply present. The teachings to Vajragoda and those other teachings that people, what happens to you after death? The Buddha said it's your question that's confusing you. Let go of the question. He didn't qualify it with a speculative answer. Well, I think maybe this, although I sometimes fall into that. When you awaken, that's not a question at all. And so whether it's speaking to it as a physical phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
which he is,
right.
But the important understanding is it's nothing to consider. There's nothing to provoke any type of that speculation even in your own life. And look what that speculation has brought us.
Mm.
Really, I mean, and again, I don't want to get into a big speech about religion and all that stuff, but rather than understanding that the most important thing is to be mindful of my life as my life occurs, rather than being distracted about what might happen and how I can manipulate that in some way.
Whether or not it happened and saying,
yeah.
No, my view of what is going to happen is right and yours is wrong.
And you never really change your behavior. One of the things, and I got to be careful, I know I'm going to get some emails about this, but since I'm thinking about it, when I was brought up Roman Catholic, and I was taught that if you did a few bad things, as long as they were, I can't remember the word now, minor, venial, if they were venial sins, mortal sins were the bad ones, but and you could go to confession, and I'm not disparaging that, I sound like I'm mocking it, I'm not, I don't mean it that way, but if you went to confession and told your sins, the priest would then absolve you of your sins, and the hope was that you would learn from that and not do it again. But I also quickly realized that I could go do the same thing again.
The point I'm making here is
that you don't really have to recognize the root of your poor behavior, do you? The Buddha teaches that your poor behavior doesn't come because you're a bad person. It's because you are ignorant of the three marks of existence. That's why you act in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But the coercion that future lives or spending eternity in hell or that the halfway house purgatory, What is, yeah, well, it's just destruction. It destroys your mind, doesn't it?
Distraction. I said distraction, but it's also destruction, yeah.
Yeah. And it's constant distraction.
Yeah.
I mean, I spent years and years and years hoping that purgatory is going to be my last stop and not the other place. You know? I knew I wasn't going to go straight up. thank you, Jen. Again, I'm not making fun of religion. It was my experience, and I good to see you.
First of all, I want to thank Jen for just what she said.
Yes.
This is the last birth until another one. yeah, I hadn't twigged onto that really. That and that brings me back to right this moment, where your mind is right this moment.
Yeah.
That's
all that matters.
I hadn't really absorbed that. And the expression they use that to when you're in a non-physical realm, when your mind is elsewhere out on wherever it goes, which is out of a non-physical realm. I mean, that's the Dharma right there, you know, just.
Yep.
And it's this sutta sort of is very specific about that. And I enjoyed his description of the world will have its way with you. You know, you're just bouncing from one to the other to the other to the other in your own little world.
Yeah.
To fulfill your own desires and non-desires, etc. You know, and you just you're not in control of your own life in that sense, that the world is you just
the you're world taking the bait of the world.
Yeah, the world goes this way, so you go with it, you know.
Yeah.
You're not and you can see that in life. I think it's a good description that, you know, the world will have its way with you, that it's a perfect description of actually from moment to moment to moment to moment what goes on in your life, but you just elsewhere in your mind and you don't see it, but that is what's happening all the time.
Yeah. And so if you're one who wants to be a Buddhist, but you want to continue to be distracted, I'm not talking about someone developing the Buddhist path, because you would quickly realize that. You will pick and choose and do this one and do that one, because it provides distraction.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, again, it's not right or wrong, except when you compare it to what a Buddha teaches. That's the difference. It's not any different or any more wrong than going out bowling on Thursday night. There's nothing wrong with it, or you know, joining a canasta. People still play canasta, or doing those. They're mostly wholesome engagements with the world, but they simply are more distraction, aren't they? And they don't get you, and they can't get you to the ultimate goal, as the Buddha teaches. And so, if we're going to practice what the Buddha teaches, we practice what the Buddha teaches. If we don't, we don't. You know, it's just that simple. But one of the most amazing things, and it was one of those big aha moments when I started actually reading the suttas, was the consistency of the Buddha's teaching. And this is what I teach, and I don't teach that, and I don't teach that for a reason. And he was always clear about that. There were things that he left ambiguous because they weren't worth the energy to address, and it would give validity to things that are rooted in ignorance. But these are the things that he did teach. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Becky, good to see you again. We missed you.
Thank you. It's so good to be here. So good to be back. I'm looking forward to attending now again, because I feel like a lot of those little burdens are stacking up. And it's because I've gotten a little bit away from my practice. Not completely away, but I realize that it's very important to keep, to be here. It's very important to be here. It's great to have this sutta on my return, because it just really reinforces everything.
Yeah, it does.
In a really basic way. It reinforces the whole Dhamma.
Yeah.
And what it means to engage with the Dhamma.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy to be back. There was one part, to be a little bit of a devil's advocate,
no, it's
that
not.
Bothered me when you were reading the Buddha's words about when he awakened, and it sounded to me like he was being a little egotistical about he was the rightly awakened one, he had the wisdom now, who could he teach this to who would understand it?
Yeah.
So I felt a little uncomfortable with that. Maybe you could help me.
Oh yeah, no, I appreciate you, because it would be easy to see arrogance and ego in those declarations,
mm-hmm.
rather than what it is an awakened human being recognizing it for himself. That he, and that line, rightly self-awakened, is so important, because he teaches us that that's what we do. We become self-awakened. In other words, it's not imposed on us in any way. It's through direct experience.
That's helpful.
And as the, and he knew at that time that he was, as far as he knew, but he knew at the time that he was the only one. And then in relation to when he was telling his friends, it was important for them to understand that. And it was out of great compassion that he held himself that way. It's also to understand in the context of the Buddha's teaching, and you'd have to really, well, you understand it. You'd have to understand the context of the Buddha's teaching to know that that isn't out of arrogance that he's saying that thing. It's simply out of great compassion. He's saying, I figured it out, and if you want to, I can teach you. I'm worthy of that. And that is out of great compassion. My little bit of speculation is thinking that must have been very uncomfortable for him too, because he was the essence of humility.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not. And that's really, and as I'm saying that, it's really, he was the essence of wisdom, meaning he understood exactly the right thing to say. One of the other remarkable things, as I'm reading the suttas, and I read a great portion of them, the Buddha never wasted a word. You know, he wasn't given into any just conversation or wrong speech. And those are well chosen words when you see them in the context. So thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you. Jay,
good to see you. We missed you the last couple of weeks.
Thanks. That's a kind thing to say. Way too much for me to absorb the comment on today. I'm sorry. I was listening. I'm diligent. You know, I'm listening to what you folks are saying and you're saying, John, but I can't come up with any particular new conclusions from it. I was just trying to follow it, and it's an education.
Yeah.
I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Thank you. There's an awful lot here. You know, so listening to it, just like you said, is the most important thing. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I think it'll deepen your understanding.
Well, that's why I continue to listen diligently.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah.
Trying to focus on all these things that matter. You know.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. Lisa, good to see you.
Good to see you too, John. We haven't been here, and I have felt myself drifting away from practice and from right thoughts and right actions. So, as other people have said, I think it's important to come and be reminded, and you can't hear it too many times.
Yes.
And it's always a little different, because every time we're here, we're in a different, I'm in a different frame of mind, even if it's a few weeks or a week or so. And so hearing it is always different, which is good, because coming and hearing it from different places in my life helps fill it out to a complete whole.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Because it's so, I mean, on one level, it's simple and easy to understand, and on other levels, it's quite daunting.
Yeah. I agree.
And there's just so much to it to absorb, so it's the doing it over and over again that's important.
Thank you. Yeah, it takes continued right effort. That's really why that sixth aspect of the path is there to remind us. We've just got to keep up with it. And it is, Lorna heard, I think you heard every, I've given this same talk on the Aryaparisamsutta on Tuesday and Saturday, Sangha, meaning two talks to the Tuesday class, two talks to the Saturday class. And you would say that each, even though this talk today was on the same subject in the same part of the sutta as Tuesday's, it's very different in certain ways too, because
and in actually it's clearer. I need to take, and I listen to them at home as well. I listen to, you know, when we go home today, typically today I would listen to this talk, and that's four times. But it gets clearer the more you hear it, and the less, I find that you hear it the first time, and your mind is like pinging off in all directions.
Yeah.
Because that's what your mind does. It's searching for other stuff to sort of like block this out. After about the third or the fourth time, you've gone through that, and you then really listening to the Dhamma. This morning I've heard every word you've said. Truly every word you've said. Mm-hmm. But that wouldn't have happened on Tuesday night.
Yeah, and I probably read this sutta 50 times. And even though I read it 46 times up until two Tuesdays ago, teaching it, I see more into it. You hear me say this often, how remarkable these teachings are. And they continue to deepen in my own mind. Again, this is a good example of this. Just how significant, I think I started the introduction saying this is one of the most significant suttas, because it is, because it helps us frame our Dhamma practice. Thank you. Kevin, good to see you.
Good to see you. Thank you, John. It's a really very extensive sutta. I'm glad that I was able to hear it. And I think in the sutta, Buddha even says that it is difficult to understand. You know, he says this is really going to be hard.
Yeah.
But then he leads you through it and leads you to the path to help you understand it. And, you know, we hope that we can adhere to that path, cultivate that path, continue the path so that we can awaken.
Yeah. Thank you. And that's really all he ever did, out of great compassion. He taught the Dhamma. Even the setting on this one, you know. Well, okay, that's a long enough class. I do try to get these classes done by 10 o'clock, but it's gotten a little... This is important to get this in. Two quick announcements. One is our Dhamma dinner's coming up, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. I think it's November 20th. There's info on the website, but I hope you can all attend. And everyone you know is welcome too, family, friends, etc. And we're taking donations to help reimburse Julie, the owner of Love and Oven, For the cost there. There's a basket out there for that. There was one other announcement, but I can't. Oh, the my schedule's changed. I no longer, for the next couple months anyway, we'll be giving a video podcast sometime on Wednesday morning, and our Thursday class here will not be here, but I'll give a Dhamma talk online at 7:15 on Thursday. And I think I have a platform that will work that we can interact to.
I didn't get one.
What's that?
I watched you on Thursday night, and
I didn't set it up yet.
Okay.
I hope to have it set up by this Thursday. But anyway, there'll be a Dhamma talk every Thursday night at 7:15 from my home. Okay, that's it. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. Again, find your relaxed meditation posture. And again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, admitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you, John, so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.